Live to see it, friends. You're listening to the World Transformed Archives on Fast Forward Radio. I'm Phil Bauermaster, and I'm pleased to welcome you to this edition of Fast Forward Radio, which first aired July 28, 2009. This was part 6 of The World Transformed, and the topic was Risks, Dystopia, and Unsettling Futures. Great panel there, consisting of Sonia Arison and Philip Van Nederveld, talking about the risks that we face to our privacy, our safety, and our very survival. So a little bit of a departure from both what we normally talk about on Fast Forward Radio and what we had been talking about up to this point on The World Transformed. Taking a look at the potential downsides, and there are numerous potential downsides. We often talk about those in context. When we talk about nanotechnology, we talk about the risks involved there, artificial intelligence, there are significant risks involved there, but we thought it would be well worth our while to take one segment of The World Transformed and devote it specifically to these existential risks, risks that can take humanity down or take civilization down. A great discussion ensues, and I think you'll find it well worth your while. Coming up on Monday, we'll be dipping once again into the Fast Forward Radio Archives, another show from November 2007, this one featuring an interview with Dr. Zheng Sui, a researcher and scientist who discovered the cancer-proof mouse, a mouse whose natural immune system seems to prevent getting or suffering from cancer, actually being able to have cancer at all. He has been working to develop treatments for human beings based on this amazing discovery, and it's a great chat with him and a reminder to us that we need to check in with Dr. Sui and see how things have progressed over the last 3 years as he's working towards, there's no other way of saying it, trying to cure cancer. So be sure and tune into that one. That one promises to be a very interesting time. We'll be back on Wednesday live with a live show, topic to be announced, and we'll be back again 1 week from tonight with the next installment of The World Transformed, Virtual Worlds and the Future of Personality. But right now we've got Risks, Dystopia, and Unsettling Futures. That's going to begin right now. Hope you'll be able to join us for all of our upcoming shows. And until next time, live to see it. Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world's changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you, man?
I'm super fantastic. How are you doing?
Well, I'm a little bit choppy tonight, I'm afraid, but we're gonna power through.
We'll know it's technology and that you're not being clipped or short with us, so we'll be okay.
That's right.
Now, before we do anything else this evening, Stephen, I have to set the record straight on something. Right at the end of last week's program, I made the big mistake of questioning your knowledge of the Apollo 11 mission. Okay, so for the record, I want the record to show that I went and checked. You were absolutely right. They did spend the night on the moon. They got up the next morning and then flew back up to rendezvous with the command module. So you were right. I was wrong to doubt you, and I want you to know that from now on, I will accept your authority on all these matters unquestioningly from here on in.
That's a dangerous thing to do, Phil.
Until you say something else I disagree with, of course. So.
Okay. There you go. That's probably a little safer.
But between now and then, you know, it's absolute. So we've got a terrific show tonight. We're up to week 6 of The World Transformed, and tonight's going to be a somewhat different show. We've been talking about major categories of transformation over the past 6 weeks. We've talked about life extension. We've talked about nanotechnology, artificial intelligence. Tonight we're going to talk about the downside. We're going to look at the dark side of transformation. So we'll be looking at risk, and we'll be looking at possible dystopias, reasons that the future can go completely wrong. And then we're going to take a look at how we might mitigate some of those risks, and what kinds of Plan B options we might put in place in order to avoid those dark futures. And we have a terrific panel lined up for this evening. I don't know, Stephen, do we still have two of the three?
That's right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So we're looking for a third panelist, but Stephen, why don't you go ahead and start with Sonia?
All right. Excuse me, Phil. Why don't you go ahead with Sonia while I get caught up in the notes?
Oh, no problem at all. All right. Well, we're very pleased to welcome Sonia Arison to Fast Forward Radio. She is an author and policy analyst who has studied the impact of new technologies on society for more than a decade. She is a senior fellow at the California-based Pacific Research Institute, and she's on the board of directors of Humanity Plus. Sonia, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thanks, Phil. And I have to say, you know, I generally think of myself as more of an optimist, so it's kind of funny that I'm on a show about risk and dystopia.
Well, that's great that you're on Fast Forward Radio, though, because we really our thrust is a very optimistic outlook on the future. So even when we delve into the dark side, I think we're going to have to spin it around to how we can prevent these things from happening towards the end. We just can't help ourselves. We have to take the positive spin. So we're really, really pleased that you were able to join us, and looking forward to talking with you this evening.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And our next guest is returning to Fast Forward Radio, Philip Van Nederveld. He is the executive director of the Foresight Institute in Europe. He's also the chief executive officer and founder of eSpaces, and he's the director of the Informational Transparency Division of the Lifeboat Foundation, where he also serves on the board of directors. He is calling into us this evening from Spain, where it is very early morning. So, Philip, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio, and good morning to you.
Hi, Phil. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Well, it's great to have you back on, and we have to tell a little story here about the last time we had Philip on, because he has been with his role with the Lifeboat Foundation, he has been our go-to guy on the subject of existential risk. And last time we had him on the program, we spoke for about an hour just on different flavors of existential risk. And that show that we did is the only show of ours that Blog Talk Radio has ever completely lost. It's the only one we have no archive of. No MP3.
That's proving existential risk is exists on radio as well.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, it couldn't have been a more perfect example of risk in place. It's the only one we've ever lost when we talked about existential risk. Now, I know nothing like that's going to happen tonight. I'm not trying to jinx our program tonight. Just thought it was a interesting little ironic thing that occurred there.
Absolutely.
So, Philip, we're very pleased to have you back on the program, and I think we will now jump into our world transformed questions. Before we get into the topic of risk and dystopia and Plan B futures, I've got two questions that we've been asking all the guests who've been on The World Transformed, who've been on Fast Forward Radio over the past few weeks, and those are as follows. Sonia, we'll start with you. The questions are, one, what is the greatest transformation of our world that you have witnessed in your lifetime? And then two, what is the greatest transformation of our world that you expect to witness in your lifetime if it's different from the previous answer?
Right. Those are really great questions. I like that you start off with those. And I'm going to have to go back and listen to all the other episodes so I can see what everybody else said. But, you know, given that I've been around for 36 years, I would say that the biggest transformation I've seen is, you know, it's incredibly obvious to me. It's obviously the internet and communications technology. I mean, that really is the biggest, most transformative thing that I have seen in the 36 years that I've been on this planet. Now, if you were to talk to my grandfather, who's 98 years old and still in great shape, he tells stories about how indoor plumbing really changed his world. and it'd be interesting to hear, the difference between, if you think that indoor plumbing or the internet was more transformative. But I'm going to go with the internet. And then for the second question, what's the biggest transformation you expect to see? It relates to the first one in that I think that communications technology, I can see it now moving into biology and merging with biology into bioinformatics. And I think that those two things together are going to transform our world in many ways. But one of the biggest things I expect to see and hope to see is the ability for us to double our life expectancies. And to that point, I'm actually working on a book looking at how, if we were able to do that, how that would change our world.
Well, that is one of the top 10 transformations that we've actually addressed as part of this 10-part series that we've been doing all summer long. And definitely that's an answer that has recurred. In fact, both of your answers we've heard more than once from various futurists who've been on the program. But I'm glad you waited and didn't go back and hear what other people said before you answered the questions. But glad that you came up with your own answers to those. Okay, how about it, Philip? What do you think? Same questions.
Well, I'm only a few years older than Sonia, so my answer to the first question is close to hers. In my personal life, I felt that the arrival of the personal computer and then later the internet really have been the most transformative. But I was there right at the beginning with the personal computer and just barely was able to get my fingers on a few of them, the very earliest ones, and start to learn programming and playing games on them, etc. And I understood right there that I was living a technological innovation and a transformative technology which was totally different from anything that my parents had ever lived through. They had seen the telephone coming and the car and television, etc. But this one was affecting my life as a teenager and deeply affecting it. So I would say, yeah, the emergence of information technology in the hands of consumers. So personal computers especially. And then as for the future, I would say the technological convergence, also known as the nanobio-info-cogno technological convergence, the NBIC convergence, that's really a grab bag category or label to group together a number of transformative technologies, very powerful emerging technologies, which are converging, or there's a confluence, a collusion of them, which will have enormous impacts severally, but also taken together. The emergence of nanofacturing with potential for personal nanofactories, the biological innovations extending lives extremely and possibly indefinitely, and then amidst all of that, the likely emergence of strong AI, of AI with at first the same level of intelligence as human beings, and probably soon thereafter far more powerful intelligence.
Well, I feel like you've cheated because it seems to me, Philip, that you've given us four or five now. We're looking for the biggest transformation. Out of all those, what do you see those all as one thing?
Well, Yes, I do see them as one thing, and I'm not the only one who does so. There is the NSF and DOC study on the NBIC convergence. They're actually the ones who coined the term, the NBIC convergence. And I think I prefer that term to the singularity, because in my view, the singularity is too focused on the emergence of stronger or higher than human intelligence in artificial forms. It kind of outshines or overemphasizes the AI part and de-emphasizes a little bit too much, to my taste, the contributions from biology and nanotechnology especially. The other thing is that your question states, within my lifetime, with AI and AGI, you know, the achievement of AGI has been elusive, has been a moving target for many decades now, and God knows, you know, we might hit further problems which push the achievement of this further and further back, and even with an extended life, an extreme life extension solution, I might not live long enough to see the advent of this powerful form of AI. If that happens, I do think that I would see the arrival of powerful nanotech. So, and that would have enormous ramifications for our societies around the world, especially the change from an age of scarcity to an age of abundance by means of personal or city level nanofactories.
Okay, well, I think that go ahead, Stephen, I'm sorry.
I was just you know, those are all positive things, Philip, and I switching, I'm going to get real quick to the dark side here. You work with the Lifeboat Foundation, and our mission is dealing with all manner of existential risk. You know, everything from malevolent AI to climate change to gray goo. What do you see is the greatest threat that we face?
Well, yes, the Lifeboat Foundation is focused on the mitigation of extinction risks, and there's a quite a long list of a catalog of horrors, and there's more than 20 of them, but you're right, not all of these have the same odds of leading to the wholesale extinction of the human race or even the partial extinction of great percentages of the human race. At the Lifeboat Foundation, we've identified three risks that we think are the most worrisome and that we worry about the most. So those three are engineered pathogens, malicious nanorobots, and unfriendly strong artificial intelligence.
Okay.
Stephen, are you still with us?
Oh, I'm sorry, I cut out for a second there, I guess. Of those three, do you have any particular one out of those three that you consider the strongest?
Stephen, what's the last part of your question?
Of those three risks, which would you pick as the one that we need to be worried about the most? You know, I'm sure the Lifeboat Foundation really focuses on all of them, but is there any one out of those we need to special attention to?
Well, you know, Stephen, unfortunately, my crystal ball is in the repair shop, and so I don't have as good a beat as usual on which of those risks will prove to be the most dangerous in practice. What I can say is that a robots risk is a very serious one, but it's not one that will rear its ugly head in the next 10 years. We expect conservatively that powerful nanotech, basically we would be surprised if it would arrive before 2020 or 2025, and we would be equally surprised if it would not have arrived by 2040 or thereabouts. So for the malicious nanorobots, we have some time. I think that the more nearer one, the arguably more urgent one, would be the engineered pathogens, because the technology needed for wreaking lots and lots of havoc with that is arguably already readily available and out there and available to the embittered few who might abuse this technology to kill a great many millions of people, if not billions. So in terms of the timing, I would say that engineered pathogens are the one that we probably need to worry about the most right now and try and do something about as soon as possible. And then the unfriendly, strong AI, that's a troublesome one, because depending on who you talk to, you get really different estimates as to when this might become a serious issue. I have several good friends who are entrepreneurs and who have started companies with the explicit goal of developing AGI. One of them is Ben Goertzel with Novamente, and the other is Peter Voss of Adaptive AI. And I'm tracking their efforts fairly closely, and even though they keep pushing back the date by when they think they will have done it, they keep saying that they feel that they are able to do it within 5 to 10 years, depending on how much money they are able to raise and how much they are able to step up their current efforts. So if you listen to those people, to Ben and Peter, then you could argue, well, if they're that close, we should look at this risk a lot closer, and we should prioritize it accordingly. However, if you listen to the critics and detractors of Ben and Peter and other AGI efforts, there are those, you know, you get all the entire range from those who say, well, it's never going to be done, and those who say, yeah, probably, but it's going to take decades, if not centuries, before we will become capable of developing AI, artificial intelligences, which are of equal intelligence to humans and then more powerful. So as far as the AI risk is concerned, the policy at Lightwood Foundation is to defer until further notice to a friend organization of ours, which is the Singularity Institute, which is focused on developing and doing public education about AGI and friendly AI particularly.
And in fact, last week we had both Ben Goertzel and Eliezer Yudkowsky from SIAI talking about artificial general intelligence and how we get to friendly artificial general intelligence. So tonight we spend a few moments here exploring the possible dark side. But let me throw the same question over to you, Sonia. What do you think? If you were to identify a greatest or most probable threat to human survival, do you think Philip covered what's on your list, or would you have any other concerns?
Well, if you're talking about human extinction, I think that the topics that he covered are the biggest ones, but there's so many other risks that we can look at, and you know, when my focus right now is longevity research, and you know, of course, the biggest risk from that point is death. not simply extinction of the human race, but death of the individual.
Right.
And, you know, there's all this longevity technology that's being developed and created right now. And so one of the risks that I'm really worried about, any kind of policies or actions that can get in the way of that technology being developed. So, for instance, any kind of government meddling with regulations or that might slow down the development of personalized medicine or, you know, say, growing organs in the lab that might help people live longer or even nanotechnology development. So that I see risks like that as well, which are on a slightly lower level. They're not exactly talking about extinction or wiping out the human race in a day or a week or something like that. But there are serious risks that we need to think about.
Absolutely, and in fact, that leads us into kind of the next level. And let me throw this one out to you. I should say that we are missing one member from our panel this evening due to a lack of good, clear communication on my part. David Brin, who was scheduled to be on the program and who was advertised to be on the program, never got the details for the show tonight, and it looks like he's not going to be able to join us. So if you're listening, David, really apologize for the mix-up on that, but we are going to be talking about some of the same topics that we would have thrown out to David and allow Sonia and Philip to talk about those. So let's look at a question that's similar to the first one. We start with this idea of the extinction level of risk. Let's move on to something that Sonia, per your point, is not at that level, but is still a significant risk. So in David's book, The Transparent Society, he writes about how pervasive surveillance technology threatens to bring an end to privacy as we know it. That's one of the sorts of risks that we face, and I think Sonia, to your point about government possibly stepping in and blocking research, this overarching role of government becomes a real risk. Now, if you were to name a most probable dystopic future, that is to say, not an extinction level future, but the future that we're running up against, where we're all still here, things have gone pear-shaped on us. Things have not worked out the way that we would have hoped. What would you see as the top candidate for that, or top candidates for that? Would it be a world without privacy, or are you more concerned about other issues?
Right. There are so many different ways that could be answered. And just thinking of David Brin and his book, The Transparent Society. I mean, one of the things that he pointed out, and I think he was right about, was there's always a problem if there's an asymmetrical ability to access information. So, for instance, if the government has access to surveillance data and the rest of the population doesn't, that creates an asymmetry that is not necessarily good for the people who are living there. Or, you know, you could look at it from another point of view, where if criminals were able to use artificial intelligence in order to steal people's data be able to steal their identities, then privacy and security would be compromised, and that could be a really big problem for society going ahead.
Absolutely. What do you think, Philip? Is that is that the sort of concern that you would have if you were to choose a dystopic, probable dystopic future?
Well, things can go really wrong, that's for sure. One of the ways that things could go wrong is that the ongoing erosion of individual privacy that has been going on for decades already and is accelerating further as we go further into this age of hyperconnectivity, is that the powers that be, the ones that are already doing the surveillance, the top-down observation of individuals and groups, etc., become or gain the ability of so-called universal surveillance. of really, really, really pervasive surveillance using, after the advent of powerful nanotechnology, panoptic smart dust for surveilling literally the whole planet with extremely fine granularity. That would be, you know, the mother of all Big Brother scenarios, and it would be a nightmare because they would have all the surveillance power, and we would be sitting pretty or not so pretty on the wrong side of that silvered mirror. However, I think there is a window of opportunity right now for a countervailing force to emerge and to arise against the abuses, the possible abuses of universal top-down state surveillance. And that would be a type of citizen watch surveillance, surveillance being the corollary or the opposite of surveillance, sous being the French word for under or from under. So surveillance would be a bottom-up countervailing force against the oncoming universal surveillance capability of states and other intelligence gathering agencies.
So, you know, I hear that term frequently, the idea of the surveillance. How does it work exactly? What does that mean? We're all watching the cops? We're, you know, how does something like that get organized, or how would you see something like that being implemented?
Well, at its core, surveillance means that the watchers are being watched. And that's just part of it, but it's really close to the heart of it. Yes, it's citizens applying technologies for watching the watchers and perhaps doing some other things than just watching the watchers. And the same technologies that will be used by the surveillance intelligence gathering agencies, like state agencies, can also be developed by the citizenry. So the panoptic smart dust, which I mentioned earlier, can also be developed in an open source fashion and with peer-to-peer technology, etc. We could develop as citizens that countervailing force to keep the watchers in check, and perhaps also do services to the community and to our societies, similar to what you already have today in the form of neighborhood watch type projects. But you see, this would be neighborhood watch type projects on steroids. We would be applying advanced intelligence gathering technologies such as the panoptic smart dust systems that are being developed.
And
okay,
so
what do you think?
Can I jump in here for a second?
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
I just wanted, you know, just to follow up on what Philip was saying. You know, you can see that phenomena happening already, where there are watchdog groups or just concerned citizens who are using technology to create this surveillance type of world, where, you know, you can think of a famous example with the Rodney King videotape in L.A. But of course, there's, you know, recently in my neighborhood here in California, the Oakland police in the Oakland subway, the Oakland subway police, you know, caught somebody in the subway, and they decided to beat him, and then they denied that they did it, but they couldn't just do that because there were people there who had their camera phones and had video of it and posted it on the web.
Right.
And it turned into a major issue here locally. And so that's an example of already this neighborhood watch meeting technology coming into existence. And like Philip says, I think it's only going to expand as other technologies come into play, and Moore's Law continues to make technologies cheaper and cheaper so that they get spread throughout the community. And that's that's a very good sign and a reason to be optimistic.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, that you know, one of the interesting stories that you see developing over the last few years, particularly with the just ubiquitousness of digital cameras, cameras embedded in cell phones. You know, people just, I think we're a lot better armed to take pictures than we used to be. And one of the things you hear about, a little bit disturbing, but that definitely occurs, is this this situation where someone will photograph a police officer and then get arrested for it, right? Even though technically under the First Amendment, that's not a crime, and you should be allowed to photograph anyone in a public place if you want to. So I think that the idea of implementing a bottom-up surveillance infrastructure is sort of happening organically. It's something that that is occurring because people have the capability to do it, and it seems to accompany just the fact that everyone's taking more pictures of everything all the time anyway. But it looks to me as though it's something that will not occur without a certain level of resistance. Would you agree with that, Sonia?
Resistance from the general population. I mean, meaning the population is.
No, not the population. I mean more the authorities. I'm thinking who will, who, for example, the cops who will arrest someone for trying to take their picture.
Yeah, well, there's always going to be that sort of resistance from the people who are in power and are losing it, and it's just a matter of keeping that balance and making sure that they're not able to resist it if we want to maintain our freedom. But you know, I was just thinking as you were talking about the cameras becoming more ubiquitous. I was thinking, you know, it's a double-edged sword because criminals can also use these things, and you know, of course, there's all those examples of you know, people snapping photos of other people in dressing rooms and in fitness centers and then posting them on the web, and so it kind of goes both ways. It helps to protect us from the authorities who might be using the technologies in ways that they shouldn't be, but the technology can also help criminals perpetrate crimes in various different ways. And as AI, as artificial intelligence gets stronger, of course, those tools become even more powerful for both the general citizenry and criminals alike.
Absolutely. Well, I guess that's what happens when something cuts both ways. If the government and the authorities are all using technology to watch us, and then we say, hey, it cuts both ways, we're going to start watching them. Well, of course, it cuts both ways. They're still watching us. So there's this there's a certain amount of back and forth that occurs between those two. What do you think, Philip? Will we be able to overcome the urge of those in authority to protect their own? Do you think that surveillance has a chance?
I definitely think surveillance has a chance. I'm worried that the window of opportunity may not be used sufficiently, because if the window of opportunity for mounting up a countervailing force that is at least that has a fighting chance to countervail the state forces, then the Big Brother scenario will take over and the window of opportunity will close, and then we will no longer have that opportunity to set up that countervailing force, because we will be watched, and people in the government, the authorities, will put a stop to it one way or another to stop an organized attempt at setting up those technologies and networks, etc. Sonia is right. There's a lot of groundswell of surveillance developing, but it will take a much more organized and focused effort to still be able to measure up to the kind of surveillance technology that will be deployed in the future by state or authorities. So there is there is a fair shot at it, but it does need to be seriously taken, and the organization needs to be developed for that. It's not just going to be a chaotic citizenry, you know, everybody having cameras on their cell phones, etc. That's not going to be enough, I'm afraid. And the other thing that is going to have to happen, and this is assuming that the countervailing force of surveillance will get traction, is people will have to accept, I think, or will have to go through a probably uncomfortable adaptation to the new reality where there is no more absolute privacy. I think people will have to throw a switch in their minds, accepting, grudgingly, perhaps kicking and screaming, that they will no longer have what I call absolute privacy. Instead, I think they will still have what I call relative privacy. So the absolute privacy means that nobody is watching you 100% certain. You know, you are 100% certain that you're alone in that room and nobody else knows what you're doing in there and who is there with you, et cetera, et cetera. That kind of privacy, I think, will be lost and lost for good sooner or later. We will still have the relative privacy, which is that one can go into a room or a place and organize a meeting with people with a fairly high probability of not being observed by a human watcher. Probably that meeting will be watched by a machine watcher, and that's what I mean by relative privacy. You can still do things that you would be uncomfortable if people would videotape it and put it on YouTube. You don't have to feel paranoid about going to the bathroom and suspecting that you are being videotaped or monitored somehow. So I think that kind of relative privacy we can still have, and that's a good thing. I'm in favor of privacy, but at the same time, we have to realize, we have to look the reality in the face, that the technologies for universal surveillance is on its way, and if we are going to mount a credible and viable countervailing force to universal surveillance, we will have to have universal surveillance, or at least near universal surveillance. And the net effect of both of those intelligence gathering efforts, technologies, the bottom up and the top down, mean that absolute privacy will be lost. And we'll have to make do with relative privacy.
Well, I'm very sorry to hear that. I will relinquish absolute privacy very slowly, I must say. Although it's interesting when you talk about the whole, I mean, it all comes down to going to the bathroom and a few other activities of that ilk, right? I mean, for me, I don't want anyone to watch me in case I have to blow my nose, right? I mean, there's certain things you just don't want people watching you doing. You feel so uncomfortable thinking that there might be someone observing you performing these very, you know, these very private, intimate acts. Although, the thing that occurred to me when you mentioned YouTube is that, and this is the thing that I think on our side of the looking glass, it's almost impossible to get our head around. But if you had universal surveillance and everyone was being recorded all the time, going to the bathroom, picking their nose, and you know whatever horrible thing people end up doing, it would never go up on YouTube. There'd just be too much material. I mean, right? It would actually become uninteresting to anyone in the world because there would be more of it than anyone would ever want to see.
Exactly,
that's not necessarily the case.
And To some extent that is the case, and it's going to become even more the case, and that's exactly why we will have relative privacy, because, 6 billion, watching 6 billion people going to the bathroom, who's going to watch that? And this stuff becomes old really quick, you know. So I think the satisfaction of prurient interests like that, first of all, as far as the surveillance aspect of that is concerned, at Liveboat Foundation, we're thinking through on these problems hard, and we think we have some protocols which we would like to try out and put in place, which would kind of catch these things early on. And basically, you wouldn't be able to usurp the surveillance intelligence gathering system for satisfying prurient interests like watching people in private moments or in moments which they would feel very uncomfortable at being publicized. I mean, the social sanction for that would also be significant because the risk of exposure of a peeping Tom becomes far greater as well. You know, the moment somebody shows, puts a video on YouTube that is at a disadvantage for another person, you can bet that other people who are perhaps kind of vigilantes will go and check up on that guy and maybe do the same thing to him or tell him, that's the last thing you've done that, because if you do that again, we have your number now. We're going to report you to the police.
Right. Okay. What do you think, Sonia? It sounded like you had a thought on that as well.
Yeah, I think, that Philip has a good point about the social sanctions being the most important barrier to stopping inappropriate material being posted on the web, inappropriate surveillance material. But the point that you brought up earlier, which I disagreed with a little bit, and I'll tell you the reason, is you brought up the point that, if everybody is being videotaped going to the bathroom or blowing their nose or any of that, there'd be so much noise on the internet that no one would even watch it anymore because there would just be so much of it there and it would just be boring and all that kind of thing. And I think that's a good argument until you think of the ability of face recognition technology or gaze technology, body recognition technology, where, okay, so say there's a whole bunch of noise and there's a whole bunch of video of lots of different people blowing their nose on the internet. It's like, okay, well, maybe you don't care about it right now, but say there's somebody that you don't like, you're targeting them in some kind of political contest or you're targeting them in some other way, then maybe you use some of this face recognition technology to specifically find the video of them blowing their nose or going to the bathroom and use that against them. And in that way, their privacy would still be violated even though there's that big noise ratio going on. So I don't think that argument quite works anymore, but I do think that the argument of the social sanctions is very powerful because, most people don't want to live in a society where they're videotaped in compromising positions.
Right.
I think that when it comes to that, we are going to be able to band together and sort of unanimously say, no, we don't want to live in that kind of society. But then that brings up the issue of, I was thinking about this earlier when Philip was speaking about the difference between the group dynamics in surveillance and surveillance, because if you look at governments who are interested in surveillance, they're very targeted, they're very organized, and so it's very easy for them to act in powerful and effective ways. When you think of surveillance, the interest is dispersed quite a bit more, and so it's more difficult, I think, to organize people unless it's something very, very obvious, like the example we were talking about with blowing your nose or going to the bathroom. So I think that that's a problem in terms of the dispersed interest and the free riding component that might go in the surveillance category.
Okay. Well, I think before we leave this topic altogether, we got a little bit not to say we got hung up on it, because I think the privacy issue is a big one. But are there any other survivable, non-extinction level futures of the dystopic variety that that either of you are concerned about that also merit bringing up?
Oh, yes. From my point of view, on the longevity tech side, or even body modification tech side, there's all sorts of things to worry about in terms of whether or not any rules are passed governing, you know, what you're allowed to do to yourself or what kind of information about yourself you're allowed to access. And even now, we're already seeing it with, you know, companies like 23andMe, a genome sequencing company that, you know, got into trouble in California because the California government said, well, you know, you're really providing medical services and you don't have a license for that and we can actually shut you down for that. And 23andMe came back and said, well, no, we're really just a information technology company. We're just providing information about people's genomes to them when they're asking for it. And then this brought up all these questions of whether or not, you know, do people have an absolute right to find out their genomic information, or does government have a role in regulating that, and can they stop that if they want to? And, you know, I think those sorts of issues, while they're not as big as the extinction issue, are really important going ahead, especially if we want to see a revolution in personalized medicine.
Absolutely. Yeah. Big issues that have to be worked out. And, you know, we did touch a little on that on our program on human enhancement a couple weeks ago when we talked about not so much the physical changes that people might make to their bodies, but, you know, when people start going in and hacking the psychological makeup, if we were to begin editing out desirable features such as, a certain desirable level of social anxiety, or to remove the fear of rejection, or to remove empathy with others. You know, there could be in certain professions and in certain circumstances people could find tremendous advantage to not having that, like, caring about your fellow human being baggage weighing them down. And if people were to start removing those proclivities from themselves, what kinds of mayhem might result? What do you think, Philip? Any other dystopias before we leave the subject and start fixing the world?
Well, there's unfortunately a long catalog of horrors out there when it comes to possible dystopias.
Yeah, so just give us your favorite. We just need a fave. You can't do them all.
I think it would be an interesting dystopia in the Chinese way of, or the Chinese meaning of the word interesting there, when a mankind unfriendly AI arises, and depending on how unfriendly that AI is, I think it could be a pretty nasty future to live in. It could also be a benign one, relatively benign one, but I think that would be highly unpleasant, or could be highly unpleasant, but in interesting ways.
Absolutely. Well, that's one that could swing us all the way back to an extinction level event for sure, right? I mean, depending on how bad it got.
Right, right. But, you know, you have to contrast that with equally dismal dystopias, which would be far less interesting in the sense that, for instance, a complete nuclear exchange, an accidental one or a terrorist-provoked one, where America and Russia and others fire all or most of their nukes, you know, that would probably throw us back a few centuries and make for a Mad Max type planet Earth, and that's technologically definitely, you know, we're just going to have to spend hundreds of years probably to reach the same level of technology again, and global trade and whatnot. So So my favorite one would be, if you can call it favorite, would be a mankind unfriendly AI rising.
Okay, yeah, and that's definitely one we've touched on not only here this evening, but that's one that we've talked about last week on the show about artificial intelligence. Stephen, how about you? You got a dystopic future for us?
I sure do. I was coming home this evening listening to NPR, and they were talking about in Washington State they're having a budget crisis, I guess like pretty much every other state, but they're, one of their things that they're doing to handle it is to release prisoners from prison who have various health problems. On the theory that, well, if you're suffering from this health problem or that, then you're not as big of a risk to society, and they can put various electronic monitoring on these folks, and they just report in from time to time. Well, the thought that hit me was, well, if we learn that it's, you know, and the thought is that if these people that are sick, the cost of treating them on the outside is so much cheaper than housing them in jails on the inside and having to treat them there. What if we were to learn that it's just cheaper to, rather than putting people in jail, that we somehow chemically incarcerate them? We require them to take medicine every day or something, where they're just basically, I don't know, stoned or whatever. And we could do that so cheaply that that's the way we ought to do it. Well, I see that as a dystopia, a type of cruel or unusual punishment. So, yeah, I guess that would be one dystopia that I would want to avoid.
That is a scary one. And, in fact, it seems to me that I've read in recent years of experiments with sex offenders where they've been not actually castrated but had the hormonal equivalent of castration performed on them in lieu of incarceration has been tried in some jurisdictions, and that seems to be very much in line with what you're talking about there. That's a frightening thought. Any from our panelists, any thoughts on Stephen's dystopia?
Yeah, well, I agree that's definitely a risk, and one that isn't necessarily too far away, given that, you know, there's research going on right now that I know of at the University of California in San Francisco, where they're getting very close to producing a nanoscale a device that goes under the skin that can simply release the exact amount of drug, of whatever drug they want, for quite a long period of time. So you could imagine that you could fill that capsule with anything you wanted, really, and forcibly implant it in someone's skin. And this could be used, by the way, not just by jails, but any, you know, some employers could require some kind of, chemical be used by their employees. Or, I mean, this could go on, the list could go on and on. So it could actually be quite a large dystopia.
Especially if you take that idea of incarcerating criminals and you turn it into a preventative thing, right? As soon as they start saying, well, these people might actually, this guy might cheat on his taxes. Let's give him a little shot of won't make you cheat on your taxes juice, right? Whatever shape it would take. I can think of a couple things. I have a tendency to drive a bit over the speed limit. They might have to, take some steps with me in that regard, and I certainly don't want to see anything like that happen. Philip, what do you think on that particular risk?
Well, I think that the taking away somebody's freedom and incarceration is a an unfortunate way of sanctioning criminals and offenders, because it shows, the statistics show that it doesn't work. I mean, yes, it keeps them off the streets, but as soon as they are back on the streets, it doesn't really significantly reduce their recidivism. And on the contrary, prisons act like academies for teaching apprentice criminals to become fully professional ones. So in the case of, for instance, the chemical neutering of sex offenders, I read an interesting article about it, which was interviewing those people actually being neutered, and interestingly, they loved it. because, one, they are not incarcerated, so they are not robbed of their freedom, but two, it relieves them of this urge which they are a slave to and which, in many cases, they don't master. So they it gives them their life back in two ways rather than just one way. I agree with Stephen that you know, you can take that to extremes, which do become dystopic. My preferred solution for preventing crime, dissuading crime, as well as actually intervening when a crime just starts and can still be mitigated, is again this panoptic smart dust technology. If that would be in place, either through surveillance and preferably also through surveillance, it would be a technology which would be able to report to the appropriate authorities any start of armed conflicts or physically violent conflicts as small as a domestic fight, as small as a parent striking a partner or their children. And the moment something starts like that, the authorities can be alerted and everything is documented, so we know who does what. I think once people understand that this technology is in place and that, you know, even when they just start having a really abusive fight, which hasn't gone physical yet, the dissuasive force of knowing that they will be monitored and the police will be on their doorstep real soon, if they even start raising their voice loudly and threatening violence, etc., would be great. And in that case, I would hope that we would not have the chemical dystopia, which Stephen alluded to. According for some other people, this then would be a dystopia where there's no more privacy. But I think the benefits, which would include no more domestic violence or other types of violence which happens behind closed doors, would significantly outweigh the downsides.
Good points. Good points. And I think that that everything you mentioned there does kind of temper the hesitancy that we might have to implement some of those kinds of things. So I can certainly imagine the kind of treatment we were talking about for sex offenders, if that were something that people began voluntarily doing, I would feel good about that. It's the precedent of the state stepping in and modifying people, particularly when the amount that can be modified and the extent to which we can be modified is increasing in such a tremendous way that it starts to make me a little bit hesitant. But you know, the other thing that occurs to me with the ubiquity of once we have artificial intelligence, once we have nanotechnology and robots and so forth, the whole idea of house arrest could be done without any chemicals or without a person even staying home, and it's done just by cranking that. How much surveillance is being done to a person up to 11 for that particular individual. So
yeah.
Great points, Philip. All right, Stephen, I think we've got about half an hour left, so if we're going to fix all these problems, we better get started.
That's right. Well, life. You've been, Sonia, you've been talking about life extension and been writing about it. You know, obviously the risk with life extension is that we don't get it, and we all live a normal length of life and then die. But let's say we do get it. Are there any downsides to that, or if so, how do we fix that?
Well, I think there's lots of change that will happen if we manage to extend our lives, and of course it all depends on how much we manage to extend our lives by. Now the way that I'm looking at it is I'm assuming that maybe we'll be able to reach ages of 150. I know some people think that we'll live a lot longer than that, but I feel like I'm being conservative in my choice of 150. And if that happens, the world will change. And there's so many, you know, this is the subject of an entire book that I'm writing, so I'm not exactly sure where to start on that. You know, in general, I actually think that it'll be a good thing, and it will be wealthier and healthier, of course, because of new technology, but that we'll have to change our expectations, and there'll be a lot more diversity in the world, and that's sometimes difficult for us to do because we're used to doing things in a certain way. So we're going to be able to change and look at the world in different ways.
Well,
I know that's slightly vague, but...
Oh, no, that's all right. I was just thinking, I wonder if there's a risk that, like, certain groups would get life extension and then others wouldn't, and obviously...
Oh, yes, that's absolutely a risk at... I think that will happen because new technologies always go to the wealthy first. We've seen that with the telephone, with cable TV, with the internet. It always goes that way. And so in the beginning, the wealthy are definitely going to get the life extension technologies before the poor do. And that situation is going to be exacerbated on the international level because, of course, the wealthier societies will get it before the poorer societies. And already today, there's a huge divide between the developed world and the developing world. So if we think the problem's big today, which it is, it's going to be even bigger in the not-too-distant future.
I guess you could also say that the rich will get to be guinea pigs for some of these things too, perhaps. So they might be on the leading edge, but to some extent they might be on the bleeding edge where they, you know, a few people that try things early actually are harmed by some of these things. So.
Yes, early adopters sometimes have problems.
With anything, right?
So what do you think?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Sonia, go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing with Steve that the early adopters can have problems.
Yeah, it's a dangerous business being an early adopter. So what do you think, Philip? Risks associated with life extension? Anything that Lifeboat is looking at there?
Well, not particularly with life extension as such, because it's not an extinction risk. It's not a technology or a development which we think may lead to the extinction of large percentages or the whole of the human race.
Kind of the opposite of an extinction risk, yeah.
Exactly.
The opposite, yeah.
Personally, I'm all in favor of extreme life extension. I'm personally involved in several initiatives aimed at not dying. And in that sense, you know, the Lifeboat Foundation is also an initiative aimed at not dying. But in that case, it's from extinction risks, and in the case of life extension, it's from the onslaughts or the insults of aging and death. So, yes, inevitably, every cloud has, well, in this case, every coin has a flip side, and yes, there are downsides to having extreme life extension spread throughout an entire population, but in that particular case, it seems to me quite clear that the upsides far outweigh the downsides.
Absolutely. I've got a great quote from Michael Anisimov in the chat room. He says, "If rich people get it a year before me, then I would prefer the technology never, ever be deployed."
Yeah. 1 year. I mean, that's
just cutting off your nose.
Yeah,
by
because gosh darn it, that's not fair. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just not fair.
Unfortunately, what he fears is the most likely scenario.
Say that again, Philip. I'm sorry, I missed that.
Unfortunately, what he fears is the most likely scenario. I mean, the wealthy and powerful have always been the earliest adopters of new technology. So it's far more likely that somebody rich will get the treatment first, especially because early on, the treatments which will successfully extend life are likely to be very expensive.
Sure. I think Michael's yanking us, actually.
I'm quite certain that he is. No,
yeah.
Having read his blog, I'm certain that he's speaking
taking that
facetiously
that's,
there.
That's a good one. Okay, so let's talk a little further about
about how we mitigate some of these risks. And Sonia, I want to spin it back around to you. I want to talk about what I like to call Plan B futures. We've talked about extinction, and we've talked about dystopias. We didn't get into some of my favorite dystopias, like I was hoping the Soylent Green future would come up, but nobody seems to want to bring that one up. But so we have the situation where, for most of us, life extension has become what I would call, it's a good Plan A, right? If everything works out well, life extension is going to kick in, and I'm going to get to live indefinitely, perhaps even. But if for whatever reason life extension doesn't get an individual to a future of an indefinite lifespan or the particular lifespan they're looking for, there's this fallback plan, this Plan B, via cryonics technology. And that's a subject that I know that you've been writing about recently. So could you step us briefly through what's going on with cryonics currently, and just for listeners who may not be familiar, briefly how it works? And is this something that you see becoming more popular? And what would be your assessment of the chances of it actually succeeding?
Well, I think that when most people hear about cryonics, they have and if they haven't heard about it before, they sort of cringe with the idea of freezing oneself, because that's essentially it's preserving oneself in one of two places. One is in Arizona, and I'm trying to think where the other one is. I think on the East Coast, for the cryonics companies. And, you know, there's different ways that you can do it. You can freeze your whole body, freeze your head, just your head. Some people believe that, you know, everything you need is in your head. And if technology comes along at some point to bring you back to animation, then, you know, maybe all you need is in your brain, because at that point they should have technology to also rebuild the body for you. So that's one Plan B for some. I would actually
now, should we subdivide this out where if you freeze your whole body, that's Plan B. If you freeze just your head, maybe that's Plan C. I don't know. Or is it B.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
And of course, there's different prices for each option. It's cheaper to do your head than it is to do your body,
That reason, are more people just preserving their heads? Is that the more popular choice now, or?
Yeah, no, I don't know for sure, but I think so.
Yeah.
I actually don't have all the information on what's going on at the various cryonics firms. And by the way, they can be very secretive, actually, because there's always been a little bit of they've always had to deal with a little bit of people questioning what they're really doing. And if you talk with some of the folks involved in cryonics, when they go to take somebody who is dying from the hospital, sometimes they have problems, even though that person has signed a contract saying that yes, they do want to be cryopreserved. And so these groups are very protective of themselves and tend to try to keep their membership private and a lot of things like that. So sometimes it's tough to actually get the details on how many people have done this or that.
Right.
I can just say at a personal level, if I were to do this, that I would just want the head done, because, I mean, you know, if we're talking about a future where they can fix that condition, then I would want the body they could provide anyway. Anyway.
Well, and that's the reasoning for a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, you definitely would want the upgrade, for sure, to get the new body. So is it your perception that this is, from what you've seen, is it being taken more seriously, I guess, than it was in the past? There have been some efforts around this since, the late 60s, is that right? And it seems to be an idea that might be very slowly catching on. That's the impression I get from a distance. Would you agree with that?
Well, there's been a few famous people who have frozen themselves, like the baseball player Ted Williams, and there was, you know, obviously the family. It became public because the family was fighting over whether or not he should really be frozen. But he had signed up for it, and I think Oprah did a show on cryonics not too long ago, about a year ago. So I think that because I think it's happening in tandem with the growth of longevity technologies, that, you know, there's all these things that are going on, like growing organs in the lab and nanotech to fight cancer and all sorts of new technologies that are going to help us live longer. And just because of that growth of media coverage of those type of things, I think that cryonics is tagging along and riding that wave of media interest and general population interest in new technologies that have anything to do with health and life and death. So I would say that cryonics is getting more interest these days. I think that the companies are actually growing their lists of people who are signing up, but I wouldn't say it's mainstream.
Yeah, it's still a long way to go before it's mainstream, for sure. Okay, what do you think, Philip? Thoughts on cryonics, or do you have a plan B future of your own that you'd like to share with us?
Actually, the latter. I happen to, and this is me with my personal hat speaking, I happen to be the co-founder of a new cryonics initiative, which came out of some people with Alcor, which is called Vistasis. And the news about cryonics really is in Europe these days. Not only with our new initiative, which would be centered in Switzerland for reasons that I'll get into in a moment, but there for going on 3 years now, there is the first Eastern European cryonics operation which has been operating, called Cryorus, and there's a
have we lost
Philip? Are you there?
I think we may have lost him.
Could be a Skype issue. Philip, if you can hear us, we can no longer hear you. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. We lost you for a moment.
Okay. What's the last that you got?
Well, you were talking about a new initiative in Europe, and why don't you take it from there?
Okay, so the news in cryonics these days is not in America anymore, it's in Europe. There is, for instance, Cryorus, which is a Russian, Eastern European cryonics operation, which has now been in operation for nearly 3 years. And then there is Vistasis, which is a new cryonics initiative that I'm co-founder of, which aims to push the envelope of
Okay, I'm pretty sure that someone is jamming the signal that doesn't want the word to get out about cryonics.
You were talking about pushing the envelope, Philip. That was the last thing we heard.
Okay, am I back?
You're back.
You're back. Go ahead.
Okay, so Vistasis seeks to push the envelope of cryonics by on the legal front as well as on the technological front. Importantly, on the legal front, we're trying to overcome limitations which seem unsurmountable in the United States. If you know that the agonal process of a person when dying is a process whereby different parts of the human body die at different speeds and rates and gradients, etc., there is the possibility, the real possibility, that damage to the brain already occurs before the heart stops beating, before the person is legally considered dead, and which is only after that time that Alcor and others can get to a patient. So we did some shopping around for a jurisdiction which might allow us to, under certain specific circumstances, start the cryonics procedure before the agonal process. So this would be pre-mortem and pre-agonal. And we're still in the middle of figuring out all the details of this, but we think we found at least one jurisdiction which might, it's a big might, but it's a real one, which might allow this. Not only would this enable us to prevent the damage or the possible damage from cerebral ischemia far more completely than post-mortem cryonics approaches are able of doing, But it would also enable us to reap other benefits which are of interest to some people interested in cryopreserving their body. That is, they would not only be preserving their body, they would also be preserving their identity. In other words, they would remain considered as legally alive. So their identity would not extinguish, which means they would preserve their assets by virtue of still being considered alive. So lots of stuff is happening, and actually this month has seen some significant progress towards achieving what I've just described, because Sergio Torero, who is in the room with me and who is also a member of the board of directors of the Lifeboat Foundation, Sergio and I have organized a meeting of movers and shakers in the field of cryonics as well as life extension. There was a representative of the SENS organization of Aubrey de Grey, Dr. Sarah Marr, to be specific. And so we had this weekend-long meeting in Toledo on the that was the 19th and the 20th, and that went actually amazingly well. So we're upbeat, and we have reason to believe that we will achieve significant progress in cryonics. It's true that cryonics has been around for quite a while now, well over 40 years, but in the United States, it seems to have gotten a little bit stuck, certainly on the legal front. On the technological front, we wish to join forces with the research efforts undertaken there in the United States for what is called full body vitrification. Right now, the state of the technology of cryonics means that if you want to maximize your chances at information retention of your personality, you really want to do a so-called neuro, which only preserves your head. With the advent of full body vitrification, which is under development, it's not yet there, we would be able to ensure quality preservation of the entire human body with risks avoided for cerebral ischemia and other damages.
Very interesting stuff. I'm intrigued to learn more about the legal status of the person in cryonic suspension in the jurisdictions that you're talking about. Philip, we'll have to have you back on the program somewhere down the road, maybe after we finish with the World Transformed, and we'd like to get more details just on that. That is absolutely fascinating stuff.
Absolutely. Sonia, is there anything we can do to protect ourselves against existential risks that we're not doing or that we ought to be doing? You have any thoughts on that?
That's a good question. Well, I think it's always a good start that we're talking about it, because that tends to lead to, you know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know.
Mm-hmm. Until you talk to other people. Yeah, I see that.
Yeah. Is there anything we're not doing? I mean, I think probably, you know, we should be talking more about how we're going to develop longevity technology from the point of view that, you know, from the risk that I was talking about earlier of there being roadblocks towards getting there, especially if they're government roadblocks. But, you know, there's also roadblocks from under-exuberance where people don't expect it to happen, or over-exuberance where they think longevity technologies are going to happen and make their lives simpler, and so they can just live however they want, and they can just throw everything away. And I mean, there's so many things that we can be talking about that could be an entire another show for you.
Yeah.
Well, we've got a lot more to do. That's for sure. So we can always hit on more of those later. What about other other steps we should be taking. Philip, do you have any final thoughts on things that we should be doing to prevent either existential or dystopic risks that we didn't cover tonight? If you had one more word you wanted to get out there, what would that be?
Well, yeah. Go and visit the Lifeboats Foundation website, lifeboat.com. Read up on all the risks that we have made an inventory of, the catalog of horrors, realize the seriousness thereof, and also look at the proposals for solutions and mitigation of each one of those risks which we are developing, and do whatever you can to help us not only formulate those solutions, but actually put them into action, realize them, because that's really what we need to do. We know the disease, we know the problem, we know the X-risks, or at least most of them. We also have a pretty good idea, and we're getting an ever better idea of what to do about them. But knowing what to do about the problems doesn't mean that what needs to be done gets done. And the Lifeboat Foundation is still a fledgling organization. We need far more resources to start putting those proposals into action and to, our planet, the reason why we're called Lifeboat Foundation is really for several reasons. It kind of points back to the absence of enough lifeboats and the bad use of lifeboats on the Titanic disaster.
Right.
And at the same time, we want to transpose that concept to the big spaceship that 6 billion of us, or nearly 7 billion of us, are traveling on, which is Spaceship Earth, which does not have any lifeboats yet. I mean, if a extinction risk were to strike planet Earth right now, either a cosmic one or a man-made one, I mean, we would be caught with our pants down. We would be in worse shape than they were on the Titanic, because at least they still did have some lifeboats and some did save some people. But on Spaceship Earth, we don't have any lifeboats. If the proposals, the solutions that we're developing at the Lifeboat Foundation are not put into action, are not executed so that X risks can be prevented and mitigated when and if they occur, then we don't have lifeboats to save our souls. Then the extinction of humanity might be total. I mean, this is extreme, but it is possible. And so we need to urgently retrofit lifeboats on planet Earth. And of course, what's even more urgent is to put in place solutions and programs which will prevent us from ever needing to have the equivalent of lifeboats for Spaceship Earth.
Absolutely. All right. Well, and once again, we'll provide the URL to the Lifeboat Foundation, so those who want to start becoming a part of that process will have the opportunity to do that. And I think per Sonia's comment, just becoming aware of these things and starting to focus on them as problems is a major step in the right direction. Well, our time has gone by very quickly. I do need to step in very, very briefly to a discussion that's occurring on the chat board. I just want to say Matt is correct that cryonics is nothing like trying to revive a side of beef. So, Sally, I know we usually agree on things, but you're wrong this time. All right. Well, I would like to thank both of our panelists. Sonia Arison, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thanks. It was great to be here.
Well, we look forward to having you back again sometime in the future. And Philip, thank you once again for being with us, and I hope that this one records this time.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for having me, guys.
All right.
Thank
and
you,
David
Bryn,
once again, big apologies about the mix-up on the notification. We hope to schedule you on a program in the very near future. Stephen, what have we got going on music-wise this evening?
Well, the song is Open Road by Nathan Lee.
All right, Nathan Lee performing Open Road. Thank you so much, Stephen, for putting that together. Thanks once again to our panelists, to our friends in the chat room. Thanks for being part of the program. Everyone listening live and to everyone listening to us via MP3, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We look forward to being with you the next time, and until then, live to see it.
shepherd.